Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Francine Prose is the author of 17 works of fiction, her latest being Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. Using a broad mix of narrative voices, she holds history and biography up to a prism, showing Paris of the 1930s as it thunders toward the Second World War, each teller offering their own imperfect version of events. Again, the title of the new novel is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It's a great pleasure to welcome Francine Prose back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Joe. It's so nice to be on the show. Thank you.
What brought you to this particular subject, this particular time? It seems as one photograph kind of got you into this.
Yeah, well, this book began with a photograph, and it was a photograph that I actually knew quite well. It was taken by Brassai, the great Hungarian-French photographer, and it's a photo of two women sitting in a bar in 1932, and one of the women is wearing a sort of spangly evening dress, and she's pretty, and the other woman is wearing a tuxedo and a man's haircut and is clearly a cross-dresser. And as I said, I'd known this photo for a while, but this was in a show in Washington, D.C. in the National Gallery in like 1999, 2000. And there was a wall text next to the photograph that said that the woman in the photo in the tuxedo was named Violette Morris and that she'd been a collaborator with the Nazis during the occupation of France. And I had never heard that before about the woman in the photo. So I went and looked it up. And of course, this is the age of the internet. You can find out everything. Within moments, I found out that in fact, Violette Morris had been a French athlete, a shot putter, javelin thrower, Olympic hopeful, and professional auto racer. And in 1935, the French government had taken away her license to compete professionally because she was a crossdresser. And somehow Hitler found out about this, and even though he was notoriously hostile to homosexuality, he invited her to be a special guest at the Berlin Olympics because she had contacts all over France with regional sports associations. And she went to Berlin as his special guest, went to the Olympics. By the time she got back to France, she was not only spying for the Germans, but she was the person who told them where the Maginot Line ended so they could invade France, the Germans could invade. And she did, in fact, go to work for the Gestapo, and she was assassinated in 1944. So the minute I found this out, I thought, you know, as we novelists say, you couldn't make this stuff up. And I thought, well, I'll do it as a nonfiction book. And then early in the process, I realized that I would have much more fun and my readers would have much more fun if I wrote it as a novel. So that's really how it began. And then as I began to try and tell her story, it expanded. I realized that I had to write about Paris when it was bright before I could write about Paris when it went dark. So the book now covers 1924 to 1944.
You wanted to get us to the point of what brought those two lovers together at the Chameleon Club.
Mm-hmm. What brought those two lovers together at the Chameleon Club, or what I call the Chameleon Club, and also what brought the photographer with them.
Right.
So in fact, I mean, one of the things I did find out that I changed and used in the book was that Brassai was not always photographing at the clubs themselves. He had a kind of mock-up of the club made in his studio. So as far as I know, this photo may have been taken in his studio or in the actual club. But by the time I got to that point, I was, you know, writing from the point of view of the photographer, writing letters to his family back in Hungary, and there's another voice who's a kind of American writer, sort of like Henry Miller. So by the time I got to the taking of that photograph, I had about six or seven different voices, all, you know, men, women, writers, resistance heroines, everyone who I felt would give a wider, broader picture of what it was like to live at that time.
The idea of multiple voices came to you almost immediately. You knew it wasn't going to just be one person telling the story.
I knew that right away. Yeah. What I didn't know was what the voices were going to be, whose voices they were going to be. And the hardest part was really finding the voice to tell the story of the woman I call Lou Villar, who was the athlete and so forth. And I tried that a number of different ways. I tried it first person, second person, letters. And it wasn't until I got the idea of writing her story as a kind of false biography and I would be the biographer, but I invented a biographer and invented a biography. And suddenly all my problems with the character, because in fact, the mystery of that character was what started me writing the book. I mean, why would someone do the things that she did? Why would someone become the person that she became? And it's a very problematic character, she is. And it wasn't until I invented the device of the biography that all my problems with the character became my biographer's problems. So I no longer had to worry about them. I just passed them off onto somebody else. So, and the biographer kind of, she's neurotic and she can't stop talking about herself, even as she's writing the biographer. So it gave me this kind of wonderful, not, I wouldn't say easy, but entertaining, at least for me, way into the story.
The idea, as you mentioned, of history and biography and truth, these are constant themes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and truth. I mean, you know, I can't complain about the early reviews. They've been, I have to say, I mean, even though I'm talking about my own book, they've been fantastic. They've just been so complimentary and intelligent. But a couple of them have said, well, maybe this would have been better if there was just one voice, you know, telling the story. Well, the fact that there are many voices is really close to my point. I mean, that is, everyone has a different idea about what happened. So when you start talking about history or experience or the past, you get six people and you'll get six different versions of what happened. And I was as interested in that as I was in just the narrative and the plot. I mean, I wanted those different versions and I wanted them to all reflect back one on the other and complement each other and contradict each other.
And all of those versions could ultimately be, quote unquote, true.
Well, all of those versions are completely true to the person who's telling you.
Right.
I mean, sure.
But it's a contradiction that is so fascinating.
It is a contradiction. And it didn't make the book any easier to write, I'll tell you that. I mean, I actually had to get a kind of, I had to get a whiteboard and make a grid and figure out what happened at what time, how old everybody was, and then try and get a grip on what actually happened historically. So at least that would give me a kind of armature on which to hang all these variant versions of the events.
As you say, you can't make this stuff up. So given the opportunity to sort of fill in the blanks, mm-hmm. How much of that was answering questions that you had that could not be answered by research and wanting to take the characters and the voices in a specific direction?
Well, I was more interested in writing a psychological novel than I was in writing a historical novel. Even though it takes place in history in the past, I like to think of it not as a historical novel, but as a contemporary novel that just happens to take place, you know, half a century ago or a little more. So really, for me, even though tons of things happen in the Berlin Olympics and auto racing and Paris in the 20s, for me, it's still a character-driven novel. So what I was interested in is the psychology of these people living through this time rather than so much the time that they were living through.
What is there, this is a very simplistic question, but what is there about Paris that is so inviting? When you pick up this book, there's just something about the time and the place that is exciting to read about.
Well, look who was there. You know, many of the modern artists of the 20th century, the writers, Hemingway was there. I mean, Picasso makes a kind of cameo appearance in the novel. And it was so much fun to write a chapter. I mean, just a brief chapter in which there's Picasso. I can make him say anything I want him to say. It's up to me. So, you know, and there was a sense of a new art being done. People were inventing lives for themselves that were very different from the lives that their parents had lived. And there was a kind of freedom in the air. And, you know, you would go to the cafes and you would meet people who were extraordinary artists.
And it's fascinating because with this grandeur and the romance comes great poverty, comes great squalor, all living side by side.
Yeah, great squalor and also great suffering when the war finally began.
Right. For the voices that are telling the story, and looking at this particular time, did you always want to keep it in a Paris perspective, in the sense of that being the place of the story?
Well, it leaves Paris briefly. It goes to the south during the war, when some of the characters take refuge there during the war. And then there's a scene that I'm particularly fond of, which is an escape scene in which two of the characters escape from the south to leave France. But basically, it takes place in Paris. And again, partly because I was thinking so much about the Brassai photographs, which are pure Paris. I mean, you look at those pictures and it's the nightclubs and the streets and the street cleaners and the gangsters and their malls. I mean, those pictures have so much of the romance of Paris and the flavor of Paris at that time. And I would look at those, you know, I have about 5 books of Brassai photographs, and I would look through them at least once a week just to get myself back in that cityscape and that, you know, what it felt like to be there. And of course, the photographer in the novel, his search, his walking the streets at night, which is again what Brassai did, is part of the story. And being a photographer, what it means, what you're looking for, what you're going out into the streets for.
And again, that brings up the question, I was saying to you this while reading the novel, that it brings up that question of truth, of looking at it, of what is the truth of what it is really like, or through that lens, through the photographer's eye, through the art form of photography.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen, I'm sure they exist, I've never seen Brassai's contact sheets. But when you look at any other photographer's contact sheets, and you look at the one he or she picked compared to the various versions of the one, it's a little like writing this novel. You know, which version are you going to pick? Mm. Are you going to pick? I mean, there's a famous example with the Dion Arbus photo of the little boy holding the hand grenade and looking like a little maniac. Well, in the contact sheets, he looks just like a little pleasant little boy. And then finally, he just gets this terrifying expression on his face, and that's the one she chose. Well, I think the same is true with any art, really. You're taking something at a particular moment. And in this novel, I'm taking something from some particular person's point of view at a particular moment. So that really was what was moving me through the book.
Francine Prose is the author of the new novel, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It is published by Harper, and she is our guest on this week's book show. The challenges of writing a psychological novel versus writing a historical novel for you?
Well, I had 6 or 7 major characters that I wanted to get into as deeply as I could. And also, even though on the surface it seems to be exploring a certain kind of thing, I mean, for example, the photographer is writing home to his parents in Hungary, as Brassai did. But I wanted to write about, let's say the relationship between grown children. I mean, I realize that's oxymoronic, between grown children and their parents, their adult parents. So in all the letters, all the emotions of that relationship, guilt, boasting, love, loyalty, separation, all those things are working into those letters. So yes, it's a letters from a guy who's a photographer living in Paris in the 20s and 30s, but it's also letters of a certain sort. I mean, if anybody wrote letters anymore, they would be the letters that a young man living today might well write his parents, or, you know, or they might be transcribed phone conversations or emails, because all those emotions, I think, are as real and as important and as powerful today as they were back then.
It is at the Chameleon Club, your Chameleon Club, where these two characters meet the photographer and where they meet each other.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about this place that brings us this vortex, if you will, of bringing everything together?
Well, it was so much fun to write, I mean, to basically invent a cross-dressers club in Paris in the 1930s. I mean, I just got to do it all. The shows, the reviews, the songs, the crowd, the waiters, everything that was going on there. I mean, and, you know, writing it, I would go into my study, and essentially it was like watching a movie of this crazy club in Paris. I mean, it was pure freedom for people. You could go into this club dressed any way you want. I mean, the photographer keeps referring to them as glorious peacocks. But, you know, these were people who during the day were lawyers and diplomats and artists, and they could dress up, you know, in the clothes of the opposite gender and be free and know that they would be free. The cops were being paid off, so there was no chance that there was going to be a mass bust and arrest. There was a kind of code of privacy and discretion. So it was complete liberation for people to go to this club.
And with that liberation comes a great deal of manipulation on lieu of getting to do all of these things.
Yeah, well, you know, like everything else, I mean, for one thing, it was a business. So one of the characters, in fact, the only character who's not written from her own point of view, is a woman named Yvonne, who's the head of the club, who's the owner of the club, and a right. singer and so forth. But she has a business to run. So they're all, you know, quite a bit of the book is about moral choices and the various choices that people made during that time. So in the lead up to the war, when there was growing nationalism all over Europe, including France, the entertainment, I mean, Lou's girlfriend or partial girlfriend becomes a kind of icon of French nationalism. So the song she sings, and it's a little, you know, nightclub ditty, becomes more nationalistic and more racist as the times go on. And Yvonne, who's the owner, has to decide how much of this she's going to permit, because on the one hand, she wants to keep her business going. On the other hand, she has a conscience. So it's a balancing act for her as well.
I was struck by something you said earlier, the escape scene that you wrote, that you were proud of. Mm-hmm. And I love to hear when writers talk about that, because often they won't. So let me ask you about something, because I'll often ask, uh-huh. is there a particular part that you're proud of? And many writers have difficulty with that question. What was it about that scene, which is hopefully you don't take this the wrong way, which is as close to a page turner as you get, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean,
I want this book to be a page turner.
Yes.
Please, Joe, it's not an insult.
I
mean, and that's how I, you know, the book was originally a third longer, and I just kept cutting it back and cutting it back because I wanted the pace to go fast. Yeah.
Right. So that scene and the mm-hmm. escape bring us to what it is that you are proud of, that you were able to achieve, and the challenges that were before you.
Well, I'm trying to think of how to do this without too many spoilers.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, it's two women leaving France, women who, because we've known so much about them in the course of the book, you would never have expected to be friends or to have anything in common. But the fact that they're escaping from occupied France together, suddenly they have a big thing in common. And someone has given them Nazi speed, you know, the speed that Nazi pilots allegedly, you know, the legend of Nazi
right.
speed. That's what they're doing. And also they're driving. I mean, a big part of the book is about driving and cars. And one of the women is related to a family that manufactures luxury automobiles. So these two women are driving this luxury automobile out of France, high on speed, talking. And for me, it was just so much fun. I mean, talk about liberating, you know, after all this sort of dark period that I've been writing about the war and the occupation, which was very intense and very dark, suddenly to sort of throw them into the sunlight and this fast car and this new friendship and you know, drugs that made them jabber the way I'm jabbering right now. It was just great. I mean, I just had a great time writing it.
And there's an excitement. There's an mm-hmm. excitement about it mm-hmm. because even though it's an escape, But there's a thrill there.
Yeah. I mean, cars and speed. I mean, that is speed, the phenomenon, not the drug.
Yes, MPH.
Right. Yes. It's a big part of the book, too. I mean, another part that I loved writing were all the auto racing scenes. I mean, what, you know, and what I had to find out about cars in the 30s and auto racing in the 30s and being able to do that was fun.
Is that an added bonus? I mean, did you ever think that you would write a book that would have a great deal to do with auto racing?
No, I can't even drive, Joe. I mean, let alone. And now I have all these books on my shelves with gorgeous pictures of. I've always liked vintage cars.
Right.
Gorgeous pictures of racing cars from the 30s. So that was pure fun.
And then you get to the larger issues here, of course, of what was being done, what this character was doing for her country, and how you ultimately, as a reader and as an author, sift through that to come to some sort of conclusion of how we should look at her actions.
Well, as I said, that was the hardest part, and that was the part that made me want to do it. I mean, the question of how somebody becomes that person. I mean, she was, or my character was, an unloved girl who many things went the wrong way for her. I mean, she had bad luck in love all the way through. And I think that when people feel a tremendous sense of resentment that things have, you know, I mean, the whole German nation was told that it was stabbed in the back by the, you know, the peace treaty of 1918. When people feel that way, that something's gone wrong and it's someone else's fault, and also there's not enough food, there's not enough money, there's shortages, there are privations, they become vulnerable to the appeal of fascism, which is what happens to her. Also, she's a French patriot. She thinks of herself as a French patriot. And even though Germany is at war with France, she has been convinced by the Germans, you know, she's also not the brightest bulb in the house. She's been convinced by the Germans that they are going to come into France and clean up France and get rid of all the enemies who have destroyed France from within, and then restore it clean and new and restore it to the French people. So she actually believes that. She's a big worshiper of Joan of Arc. I mean, she thinks of herself as a kind of, in the model of Joan of Arc. I mean, the cross-dressing is included, the heroine of battle is included, the leader. I mean, so that is the model that she has for herself. And of course, it's a nationalistic model, but that's hers.
You mentioned the early reviews, and in some of the blurbs that I have seen and some of the early reviews, I saw at least two references of saying that you are very chameleon-like in this book.
In this book? Well, yes. I mean, it was great because I could become at least seven different people depending on whose voice I was writing in that day. None of them were me. None of them were anything like. I mean, I used things from my own life, certainly in my own observation. But there wasn't a single character with whom I identified, in a sense. I mean, I had great sympathy for all of them. And the trick was to create sympathy for the least likable characters. But I just became a different person day by day. It was, I mean, why else would you want to write?
And again, the psychological side of it is having us work through, as readers, having us work through this and coming to a conclusion or conclusions, and you want to explore this as well. I mean, you're right there with us, right?
Yeah, I mean, in every way. For one thing, I had no idea where the book was going, so I recreated the experience of reading it as I was writing it, because I was, you know, it was a shock to me finally where it was going to end up. And I felt that I was meeting these people and discovering these people and learning about this time and experiencing this time. And it was all happening as I was writing it.
It's a beautiful novel.
Thank you, Joe. It really
is gorgeous. It's entitled Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It is published by Harper. Francine Prose, it's always a pleasure to have you on this program. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Joe.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@WAMC, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at WAMC.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
Pour réussir en tout, avoir tous les atouts, dont on l'a dit, il faut avoir du culot. Quand une femme est jolie, bien que ce ne soit pas poli, je m'attache à ses pas en me disant tout bas, histoire de voir ce que ça donnera, histoire de voir si ça rendra. Suivons de loin, ma foi nous verrons bien, car qui ne risque rien n'a rien. De seules choses peuvent se produire, elle rira ou ne voudra pas rire. Histoire de voir ce que ça donnera. Vous avez ri, alors ça va.